Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. The federal government concedes a costly mistake. The WIP in New Mexico will not be tested to accept weapons-grade uranium. Observers say this is a wise decision by the Clinton administration. Others say there is more to the story. We'll have the story. Also this time, dishing up another visit with the environmental gardener and assessing the loss of Ted Parker and Al Gentry.
The ability to get out there, to bring a lifetime of experience to bear on the condition and the uniqueness of a forest in much the same way that a good physician can in diagnosing human illness.
These stories this time on The Environment Show. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. We built nuclear missiles and bombs, and now we have the garbage left over. Garbage called transuranic waste, a special grade of nuclear waste. The Federal Department of Energy wants to bury this transuranic waste beneath the sands of the desert near Carlsbad, New Mexico. However, having spent billions of dollars to develop the project at WIP, the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, the DOE has now changed its mind, at least for the moment. Robert Neal is director of the Environmental Evaluation Group in Albuquerque, a group funded by but operating independently from the Department of Energy. Neal says his group monitors and evaluates the DOE at the WIP site. To understand what DOE has done, Neal says we need to understand what is involved in the project.
The purpose of WIP is to permanently dispose of all the nation's defense transuranic waste that were generated for defense purposes by the Department of Energy. These waste materials are located at 10 different sites in the U.S., and due to their very long-lived activity, the intent is to permanently dispose of them at the WIP site, which is 25 miles east of Carlsbad, in a layer of bedded salt. DOE recently estimated that the total cumulative cost of the WIP project will be close to $9 billion. When I first started this job in 1980, the expected cost was only $1 billion. The intent is to dispose of all the transuranic waste. These are radioactive waste materials that are heavier than uranium in the periodic table. We're talking about perhaps 6 million cubic feet, 850,000 drums, a number of canisters, and a total curie inventory of less than perhaps 8 million curies of radioactive material at this point.
Neal says this is about 25,000 truckloads. Though this sounds very large, indeed, Neal says the actual site does not occupy but a small piece of underground real estate at the site. In fact, Neal says 70% of the waste intended for the facility has not yet been generated. There is room to grow. Before the facility can open, though, the DOE has to establish that it is going to work properly. To do this, the DOE had planned to conduct tests on site, at tremendous costs, as we have just heard. However, now, the DOE has a new game plan. Until last October, the DOE was both building and monitoring the project. In October of 1992, Congress turned over the monitoring function to the EPA, feeling the other way was too much like the fox guarding the chicken coop. Though it became clear EPA standards are more stringent than those at the Department of Energy, the DOE maintained its position of planning to conduct the testing on site. Neal recommended against it for three reasons.
One, the requirements in the WIP Land Withdrawal Act require that the data be shown to be directly relevant to meeting the compliance standards of EPA. That hadn't been done. Secondly, the proposed schedule to get the data would not have made it available until after the completion of these performance assessment analyses and calculations to show compliance. And the third problem was that there were a number of unresolved engineering problems that had never been addressed by DOE. For example, after 3 years of characterization of the waste, we only had a little more than one truckload of waste prepared and available for these experiments at the site. And our point is that those resources could be better addressed to showing compliance with the disposal requirements of EPA and not be diverted towards these short-term experiments, which are of marginal value.
One of the chief concerns has to do with solubility. How easily does this transuranic material either dissolve or resist dissolution in water that might find its way into the salt caverns? To test the solubility, Neil says, the DOE does not need to enter the underground facility itself. A high-level laboratory will not only provide the same data, Neil says the experiments will actually be more controlled, and thus the data more accurate. Neil commends the DOE for recognizing the folly of spending so much money on a project with so little chance of success. But is this all there is to it? Don Hancock is a leading research advocate with the Southwest Research and Information Center in Albuquerque, a group founded in 1971 and, for the past 15 years, fighting WIP. Hancock commends the DOE on the wisdom of its decision, but...
DOE has coupled this decision with essentially financial payoffs to the city of Carlsbad that are not based on science or good public policy or reducing the budget or speeding up the opening of the WIP project, all of which are explanations and rationale DOE gave for the decision to drop the test.
Specifically, Hancock says, instead of developing WIP, DOE is proposing to fund and develop a National Transuranic Waste Program Center in Carlsbad. Hancock says this simply does not make any more sense than pursuing WIP itself did.
The majority of the transuranic waste in this country, and transuranic waste is a kind of intermediate level waste. It's not high level waste, it's not low level waste, it is long lived, it has a lot of plutonium in it, and it's generated from production of nuclear bombs. Most of this transuranic waste is currently stored in Washington State, Idaho, Tennessee, and South Carolina. Of course, none of those locations are at all proximate to the WIP site, and so there seems to be no reason to site this facility in Carlsbad.
In addition, Hancock says the DOE has promised the city government in Carlsbad that a staff currently employed in Albuquerque working on the WIP will be transferred to Carlsbad for this new project. Hancock says this, too, does not make sense, saving money by canceling the one project and spending it on retraining the workers for the new project. Hancock says it comes down to this.
The supporters of WIP in Carlsbad, which are the Chamber of Commerce and the mayor and other clearly important people in Carlsbad, are saying, we've been supporting this project, don't you dare do anything that will take jobs and money away from Carlsbad. So the cutting some jobs at WIP by stopping the test program is being replaced by bringing other jobs in that don't necessarily have much of a purpose either, but are ways of keeping essentially the same number of jobs in Carlsbad. And so it's a reward to Carlsbad. It's a way of essentially having the city fathers of Carlsbad acquiesce to this decision to not proceed with the tests. The long-term problem, of course, is that DOE wants to continue spending $200 million a year on WIP, a facility that has no nuclear waste, and is cutting back on the money that it spends at some of its other facilities in other parts of the country that have a large amount of nuclear waste that is dangerous to workers and the public and is contaminating the environment. So it seems like it's sort of pork barrel politics, reward your friends as opposed to do the thing that is most important scientifically or makes the most sense technically or in terms of using the budget.
While the recent decision by the DOE to curtail on-site activities at WIP means a certain savings, Hancock says not too far down the road, Congress is going to have to look at the situation. The cost of WIP is just too large to toss off as a small mistake.
The WIP project currently looks to be about a $10 billion project, so it's on the order of the magnitude of the superconducting supercollider that after spending a couple of billion dollars on Congress has now decided to terminate. Well, WIP long-term looks like as big a budget project as the Super Collider. We haven't yet sunk as much, quite as much money into it. There's been about $1.5 billion spent on this project up to now. But at some point, if the administration is willing to look at what WIP would do and the budget for it and whether it's a good and safe project, Congress may have to do that.
While most observers say the DOE's decision is smart and prudent, reversing a boondoggle of the previous administration, others see it as having won a battle while the war still rages. No doubt all sides would agree this is a very serious problem. Perhaps as with no other situation, we are dealing with future history. The life of this toxic material is so long that it will threaten and be present in the lives of generations thousands of years from now. Not only must we store this material in just the right way, we must make it as unobtainable as possible. Otherwise, says Neil, consider this two-part scenario.
Now, future generations may be puzzled if we put up an elaborate sign above wastes that are located 2,000 feet underground, and we don't have similar signs over wastes that are buried at different generating sites under 2 feet of dirt. They'll say, what kind of a society is this? They put up these elaborate signs where the material was placed at a great depth. The second thing you have to be careful about on a sign is it can be a very encouraging thing to dig into. I've often said that if we found a sign outside one of our major cities in an ancient Sumerian script that said, whatever you do, do not dig here. That, some horrors are below the ground. On Monday morning, we'd all have our earth-moving equipment there ready to start digging away to see what the heck is underground.
Robert Neal, director of the Environmental Evaluation Group based in Albuquerque. Don Hancock is with the Southwest Research and Information Center, also in Albuquerque. And this is Bruce Robertson. Having a summer vegetable garden is a lot of work. The hot sun, the back-breaking work weeding and raking, the frustration of seeing so much get eaten by insects and animals. Isn't it just as easy to buy your fresh produce at the grocery store? Well, maybe. Maybe not. Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, is convinced the real point to gardening is apparent when you see it all from a different perspective. He's been cooking up a plan he says will convince us, too. Okay, let's see if Larry's home here. Hey, Larry, you home?
Bruce, yeah, come on in. I'm in the kitchen.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm all right. You came over on a good day.
What are you doing in the kitchen?
Well, I'm in here making up some stir-fried Chinese vegetables. Remember a few months ago you came by and I was planting my fall garden, and I told you if I had all, I was going to have all these Chinese vegetables?
Indeed, I do remember, and indeed, I also remember looking forward to tasting the fruits of your labor.
That's right, and I've got, here's what I have for you today. I'm going to make up a plate of stir-fried Chinese vegetables, and let me tell you what I have. And these are all things that I planted earlier this fall. One is this nice-looking purple-stem Chinese cabbage, and here is a nice long-leaf celery or Napa-style Chinese cabbage that I'm going to cut up. This is some arugula. This is all common with Italian food, but also tastes a lot like watercress, really good in Chinese food. And these are daikon radishes. These are big, long, white radishes that are actually very sweet, very popular, kind of tastes like turnips, very popular in Chinese cooking. So how about it?
And here it is coming into November. We're in November, closing in on Thanksgiving time. It's frost in the ground. Most of the leaves are down. And you just picked these today?
I just went out and picked them today. And that's one of the great things about planting a fall garden. I was encouraging everybody to plant a fall garden, especially you. And I said, if you plant a fall garden now, you'll have vegetables all the way through till Thanksgiving. Here it is, almost Thanksgiving. I've got these great, beautiful green vegetables, and I don't see them stopping. Now, we've had several hard frosts up here. The ground isn't frozen yet, but I still see a lot of vegetables coming from my garden. And as a matter of fact, I see a lot of vegetables coming for you right now. Let me toss some of these in here. And now there goes the little daikons, because they take a little longer to cook. And I've got my big old cast iron wok that I bought.
Larry, while those are starting to simmer, I suppose to some degree the vegetable quantity would be limited by how much you ended up planting, but how long into the frost and frozen season and the snow could you afford to go and still be able to pick these and eat them?
Well, I think I've had these, the daikon radish will be just like any other root crop that grows underground. This will you can cover this up with a little mulch and then harvest it throughout the dead of winter, just like you would with carrots and parsnips and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the cabbages, I've noticed that the arugula and some of these other cabbages can take a snow. Last year, I harvested cabbages, these little cabbage leaves, in the snow. So, you know, it'll go on quite a while. And they've been hit by a couple frosts where most everything else in the garden is completely dead. But these things keep growing. They actually thrive in this cool weather.
So you can really almost join one season with the other. The end of one season still growing and just before you start planting your next season.
Yes, especially if you live in some of the more southern states. If you lived in Tennessee or southern Missouri or Texas or some of those places, you could, if you planted the right kind of vegetables at the right time, almost have vegetables all year round with no trouble at all.
Well, it sounds and smells good. I'm looking forward to taking a taste here.
Well, that's one of the things. People, you know, we always talk about working in the garden, but there's also a lot of benefits from being in the garden. And one of the benefits is having a great big platter of Chinese vegetables like this. So let me, it's starting to smell good now. Let me get a little soy sauce on here. Just a little bit for you. Now, you know, a lot of these vegetables are also very nutritious. If I can get the cap off my, there we go. A little soy sauce.
Listen, I tell you what, I'm going to take my coat off and stay a while and get ready to sit down and enjoy a plate of your stir-fried vegetables.
Oh, great, great. I've got plenty and I'm looking forward to serving you.
Okay, I'll see you in just a second, Larry.
I'll see you now.
Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, author of Beautiful Easy Gardens. The aroma of stir-fried vegetables fills his home in Hollowville, New York. This is Bruce Robertson. The loss of human life under any circumstances is sad. When those circumstances are gruesome, the death is tragic. We say this of our fallen national leaders as we say it of our family and friends. Our planet Earth has lost two of its brothers. Theodore Parker and Alwyn Gentry died when their small plane crashed into a fog-smothered mountainside in the tropical forest of Ecuador. Three others also died. Perhaps we will never know what happened, nor certainly what their last thoughts were. But we do know that with them died an incredible amount of undocumented research, information that will be difficult, if not impossible, to reconstruct. Dr. Peter Raven, director of the Missouri Botanical Garden, said these two scientists were truly extraordinary.
Ted Parker was one of the very few people who could go into a forest in Latin America and doing so, identify all the birds in that forest basically by their calls. There are 9,000 species of birds in the world, and he's supposed to have been able to recognize about half of them by their call alone. In other words, he could go into a forest in Peru at dawn and maybe pick off 250 species of birds without seeing any of them, just listening to them singing in the tops of the trees. In other words, he had an unbelievable ability to discriminate bird songs and to recognize them in that way, and was undoubtedly the person in the world best suited to recognizing those birds in that way.
Alwyn Gentry, Raven says, was phenomenal in another way.
He probably had the widest knowledge of lowland and middle elevation Latin American plants of anybody who ever lived, because he could he traveled so widely. It's much more difficult to go into a forest and recognize all the plants that are there than it is to recognize the birds, because they don't sing. There's nothing comparable to song that can easily be used as an index to what's there. You have to go in, you look at the trees of plants, which maybe the trunks go up 100 feet before they begin to divide, and somewhere way up there in the green above you might be little clusters of white flowers the size of a pinhead. You have to be able to know the trunk, the leaves, and so forth well enough to pick out what's there, and to have had enough experience so that when you go into a forest, you can, again, say how distinctive it might be. It's a very rare skill, and it's a skill that's based on a lifetime of experience. And that experience, of course, when Dal died, went with him.
Gentry and Parker were involved in what was known as a rapid assessment program, a kind of research SWAT team, gathering data sometimes even as it was being destroyed. Ronald Sullivan, in his article on Parker and Alwyn in the New York Times shortly after their death, recalled how Gentry once was taking an inventory of plants in one study area while a bulldozer was smashing down trees and plants just a few yards away. Raven says in the death of Al Gentry, and to a different degree with the death of Ted Parker, we lost not so much the actual information they had collected, but the way to collect that information.
For example, why an expert system, that is a computer that makes point-by-point discriminations, can never be quite as can never quite do the same thing as a good physician can do in diagnosing illness. You bring in so many points intuitively, and you digest them based on your own experience in a way that is very difficult to write down. Not impossible, but very difficult. And that's what was really lost with Al Gentry and Ted Parker, the ability to get out there, to bring a lifetime of experience to bear on the condition and the uniqueness of a forest in much the same way that a good physician can in diagnosing human illness.
Tell us about the plane crash itself. What were they doing in? Where were they, and what were they doing there at the time?
Near Guayaquil, on the Pacific Forest of Ecuador, which is one of the areas that Al and Ted had studied the most, finishing off a day of field work, actually a short field trip of about 10 days duration, and flying into Guayaquil to come back to the United States. When somebody said, let's go back and look at some other particular patches of forest to see where we should better go next, to see what the important points places might be for our next visit. And given that, so the pilot said, okay, flew down into the clouds and immediately crashed. Flew into the side of the only mountain in that part of Ecuador. It was just the characteristic way that accidents usually happen in skiing or in any other way, which is you do one more trip or one more run or one more visit, and in that case it proved to be one too many.
Do you recall the time and the circumstances, and most importantly, your immediate reaction when you learned the news of the death of these colleagues and friends?
We learned about it at night after a dinner that we'd given for visitors from Peru, actually, here at the garden. And the news came in, and of course it was starkly unbelievable. We just couldn't accept the fact that they were gone. Al had about a dozen PhD students at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, and at Washington University. And they gathered really in disbelief. You know, most of them had come here to study with him. And when this news came through, it did not seem possible to anybody. So many people spent most of the night up wondering what had gone wrong and why this had happened, and worrying about it, thinking about what it meant for them, some people crying and other people, just as I say, stunned in disbelief.
Dr. Peter Raven, director of the Missouri Botanical Garden, recalling the tragic deaths of Ted Parker and Alwyn Gentry, whose plane went down in a fog-shrouded forest in the mountains of Ecuador in August. It may be years, if ever, that we recover the information and the skills they had developed in the fight to learn about and save tropical forests. This is Bruce Robertson. Well, that's our report on this edition of The Environment Show. We thank you much for joining us, and be sure to tune in next week at this same time for another edition. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, number 202. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.